detention of SE.
Good morning, Richard Lechick on behalf of the appellant SE. I'll reserve 3 minutes. Under Article 1, Section 21 of the Washington State Constitution, the right to trial by jury shall remain inviolate. This provision enshrines the jury right as it existed at the time of the adoption of our state constitution in 1889. At that time, parties had a right to a jury trial in mental illness proceedings. Accordingly, that right is preserved inviolate and continues to exist today. In this case, SE was subject to a petition to involuntarily commit her for 14 days of treatment based on her mental health, the allegation being that she had a mental illness that posed a substantial risk to others. The court rules and the statutes, however, did not permit SE to demand a trial by jury as the Constitution requires. Accordingly, the order of commitment should be reversed. The analysis the court embarks on when we decide whether there's a jury right is a two-part test, and it's set out in the famous Sophie case. And what we do is we examine the scope of the jury right as it existed in 1889. In other words, what is the jury deciding? Does a jury get to decide that rather than a judge? And then we analyze whether the cause of action is analogous to one in 1889 and whether you got a jury trial in those types of actions.
Do we analyze the stage of the proceeding in analyzing the cause of action, right? There's a right to a jury trial in a criminal case. There's no right to a jury trial when there's a finding of probable cause made and bail is set. Right.
That's correct. And you know, while this is caused...
The statute that you challenge the constitutionality of refers to the hearing that we're talking about as a probable cause hearing. Was there a probable cause hearing in mental illness cases in 1890?
I don't know the answer to that, but...
You have the burden of proving that the statute that you challenge is unconstitutional. So we're looking at whether or not the proceeding to which your claim that a jury trial right applies is the same as a proceeding in 1890. Well, and my question is, with regard to the probable cause hearing set forth in the statute that you challenge, was there an analogous proceeding in 1890?
The analogous proceeding is that there were insanity commitments in 1889. Now, they call this a probable cause determination.
Did the jury trials that were commenced pursuant to the territorial statute, which carried over on what now is Armistice Day or Veterans Day, but then was the day of statehood in 1889, those jury trials, were those commenced within 72 hours of the person being taken into commitment?
I don't know the answer to that question.
Okay.
So, but in
do we
this
need
case,
to know the answer to that question to know whether people were being treated variously?
No. So let me set up the procedure. So first, the state can detain somebody for 72 hours.
No, we know that.
Okay.
Right. So we're trying to get beyond just how does the statute work now? I'm trying to get to how did the statute work then, because your assertion is based on a notion that people are being treated differently and less constitutionally fairly now than they were treated in 1890.
Correct.
And that the basis for that is there is no jury trial commenced within 72 hours of them being taken into commitment if the state wants to continue their commitment for another 14 days.
That's not the basis. So a probable cause determination in a criminal case is you're holding a person until you can hold the trial, the cause of action. The cause of action here is a petition that authorizes the commitment and deprivation of 14 days of liberty, suspends a constitutional right, the right to bear arms.
Were people in 1890 held for up to 17 days initial 72 hours plus 14 days. Were people in 1890 held for up to 17 days without there being a jury trial?
I don't know the answer to that question, Your Honor.
Well, if you have the burden of showing that the statute's unconstitutional, don't you have to provide us with the facts from which we can judge whether or not people are being treated at variance with how they were treated in 1890?
I don't think the analysis is quite that specific. So the Supreme Court, when we analyze whether an action is analogous, it doesn't have to be an exact fit. On the Sophie case, both the majority and the dissent reasoned that the tort actions in that case were analogous to the ones in 1889, even though these were new tort actions.
Right. That didn't but there is a jury trial provided in this statutory scheme.
Only
one for 90 days of commitment, one for 180
days. Yes, and this is after a person's already the judicial order has confined a person for 14 days and deprived them of a constitutional right and their liberty. And in a true probable
and
cause determination, that does not happen.
And that did not happen in 1890?
Nope. I mean, I don't know the answer to that question, but I don't think it did. I think ordinarily a person might be held by while they await trial and the ultimate judicial orders.
Hypothetically, let's assume we know these things. Hypothetically, in 1949, there was a statute that said that a person could be held up to 60 days after they were taken into custody on a charge and what was called a charge of insanity. Hypothetically, in 1915, there was a statute that provided that time period was 30 days and could be extended another 30 days. Do the knowledge of those two hypothetical facts inform us in any way as to what might have been the state of affairs in 1890?
Statutes passed subsequently to 1889 do not necessarily inform. I mean, the analysis is what were the statutes in existence at the time of the ratification of our state constitution.
But those statutes didn't, they involved just a court order. There was no jury trial.
Well, you had a right to demand a jury trial when
not,
were brought
not
for insanity.
Not hypothetically in the 1915 statute, nor hypothetically in the 1949 statute. We'll come back in 10 minutes.
I do have one question to leave with you, and that is, maybe you know the answer right off the bat, is in your analysis, is a person entitled to a jury trial before the 72-hour detention?
I would think not. And other states actually have, you know, what I would call a true probable cause hearing where you're detained. You know, a court makes a finding probable cause that we have to detain you, and then they have a trial or a hearing later on. So my understanding is you can be detained for 72 hours, and then you don't have a right to a jury trial on that initial detainment, sort of like in a criminal case.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Stephanie Brennan, on behalf of the respondent. We are here today in regards to two issues. Whether a jury trial is required for 14-day hearings, constitutionally required. And the second issue is whether there was sufficient evidence to hold SE under the gravely disabled B prong and the harm to others prong.
Focusing in on the first question, do you know apropos of counsel's last statement, do you know if there are other states that have systems that require a jury trial before the 14-day commitment?
No, Your Honor. I did not look into other states, but I did look through our historical laws, looking to the territorial laws and then the first laws of the state of Washington, and then I looked to further laws as it would inform the current statute today.
Do you happen to know whether under the Seventh Amendment of the United States Constitution, a person is entitled to a jury trial for involuntary commitment? That's okay if you don't know.
No, Your Honor. There was a discussion in the case about that and whether the Washington State's laws were greater in regards to that, but I can't speak to that.
Okay. Go ahead.
In your review of the territorial statutes, was there any analogous procedure where someone is detained on base of some judicial finding prior to the actual trial occurring? Or how was somebody held before trial on an insanity allegation in the territory?
No, Your Honor. So the territorial laws, as far as I can tell, and as I provided in the supplemental authorities, someone would petition for someone to be held, and then there would be a hearing, and it could be before a judge or a jury. That came later in, I believe, 1883. And then there was no time frame on which they could be held. They would be held until the superintendent deemed it expedient that they be released. I could not find any reference to the time frame in which the hearings would occur or when the person would be released. It was sort of when someone would discover they were no longer mentally ill or the superintendent deemed them to be released. And that was consistent then.
Did you just say you weren't able to find anything with regard to when the jury trials commenced?
Yes, and that was the territorial laws in terms of the time frame to which they had to happen. Now, and that was
How about 1890, 2 months after statehood? When did the jury trials commence?
I believe that was then still consistent with the territorial laws. And so, and also that the superintendent still held the power to release them at his discretion. Where I saw a change was the RCW 7102, which allowed for a 60-day review period. Now, I will say the statute reads a 60-day review period for evaluation unless a jury trial is requested, and that then indicates a longer period. However, I will note for the court, subsequent case law seems to indicate that portion is not, should not be followed, because that's the indefinite detention that is the concern. But the 60-day, I didn't see any issue with the holding them for 60-day for an evaluation period that was in RCW 7102.
Let me ask you this. The in 1889, the territorial statute that carried over referred these matters to the probate court. A separate statute, effective in 1899, said that the probate court was to hold sessions every 60 days and then listed the day of the month on which those sessions would begin. In 1915, the legislature passed a bill which provided for 30 days of evaluation that could be extended to 60 days of evaluation. Then, as you pointed out in your submittals, in 1949, the legislature recodified that, took it out of Remington's laws, made it into the RCW, and made it a 60-day period. We have 60 days upon which probate courts, during which probate courts were to begin a session, 30 days plus 30 days in a statute in 1915, 60 days in a statute from 1949. Should we discern anything about that with regard to what the outer limit was for the commencement of the jury trials that were required by the statute in effect in 1889?
Here's where I think that comes into play. First of all, I don't believe there is an inviolate right for a jury trial at the 14-day, 90-day, or 180-day hearings, because I don't believe that those hearings are analogous to the hearings where someone was detained indefinitely.
So are you saying that if the legislature now decided to change the statute so that a person didn't really have a jury trial until after they'd been in for 180 days, that that would be found constitutional under the state constitution?
Yes, I think the argument is that the concern is that they want people to be reviewed, and they don't want they don't want an abuse of the indefinite commitments. And so those indefinite commitments have...
Whose concern is that? I mean, you're talking about the constitutional concern under the Constitution?
The legislative intent of RCW 7105, when it was put in place, when it took the place of RCW 7102, which still had indefinite commitments.
Do we have to agree with you on this proposition in order to agree with you on the proposition that's presented in the assignment of error?
That's where I think your previous question comes into play, is that I think this is a new issue for the court as to whether jury trials are required for 14-day hearings, that direct question. However, I think that this process of not having jury trials within the 14 days has existed in the past, and that goes back to RCW 7102 and the prior statutes where people were held for evaluation periods for they were found, there were probable cause, they were found and held, evaluated, and then they had their hearing or their jury trial.
So you're saying that, in your understanding, that period of review and evaluation before the trial could be more or less indefinite? until they got through reviewing and evaluating?
No, I think it before it was 60 days, and now I think it's covered by the 14-day hearing, the probable cause hearing. I think that that addresses that need for review, but I don't think that having that a jury trial at 90 days or 180 days is constitutionally required. It's legislatively required, but I don't think it's constitutionally required because it's not ordering someone to an indefinite commitment. And this is consistent with the analysis in Henry the Detention of M.W., the Supreme Court case from 2016, where even they noted that they hadn't determined whether that a jury trial was required for the ITA holds because they were different than the indefinite commitments.
So I want to make sure I understand this. At what point in time, under the state's position, would a jury trial be constitutionally required?
If someone was being held for indefinite commitments. And I think that is consistent if you look, you
what
know.
What if it was just 10 years?
I mean, that's not an indefinite commitment,
no.
But.
If it was 73 years.
That's also not an indefinite commitment.
What if it was 173 years?
Also not an indefinite commitment.
There's a point at which your position appears to break down.
There is, but the statute provides for due process and review.
Well, we know two things are true. We know that in the law that became in effect in 1973, the legislature stated as one of its purposes that it wished to cause to be ceased the over occurrence of indefinite commitments of the mentally ill. And we know that it believed that it was appropriate to provide jury trials for 180 day commitments and 90 day commitments. We should take nothing from that with regard to the legislature's view of the constitutional imperatives that were upon it in formulating this new bill.
I think appropriateness and the constitutional requirement are two separate things. So I think it's important to look at the scope of the constitutional right in 1889, and to require a jury trial because it's an inviolate right gets to the scope then, and that wasn't a limitless.
Let me change your focus for just a minute back to the particular question at issue and history. If we were to be of the view that a statute that required probate courts to come into session no longer than every 60 days and referred these matters to a probate court would result in there being no more than 60 days before the jury trial could commence, if we were to think that that might be so, did you run across anything that indicated that jury trials commenced with any regularity or with no regularity at all within 72 hours of the person being brought into custody in 1889 or 1890?
No, I couldn't find. There is no indication that there is a requirement to have a jury trial in 72 hours.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I would encourage your honors to take another look at the Sherwin v. Arvison case, and that's from 1981, and it did involve the ITA scheme. And in that case, our Supreme Court said that the subject matter in 14-day and 90-day detention proceedings are, quote, the same. And in that case, there was a challenge that a person subject to a 90-day petition had argued that his trial had been held in the wrong venue, and that he had a constitutional right under the jury right to be tried in a certain venue. And the Supreme Court, in addressing that claim and rejecting it, recognized that the subject matter in 14-day and 90-day petitions are the same.
Let me ask you about another question you cited to us. In re Ellern, you cited to us.
Yeah.
In the factual recitation in Ellern, it wasn't treated as a legal issue. In the factual recitation in Ellern, we're told that he was caused by the judge to be taken into custody upon the complaint on February 15th of 1944, and his trial commenced on March 20th of 1944. How could it be that more than 72 hours passed without his jury trial having commenced, and the Supreme Court assigned no significance to it?
Well, I don't think that was that issue was raised. If my recollection of that case,
no, it wasn't
was,
raised.
Was
no
about,
one,
was
no one in the case seemed to think it was significant at all. My question is, how could that possibly be, if you had to have a hearing in less than 35 days that was a jury trial?
I think we're confusing, your right to be brought in front of a court for a hearing with whether you have a right to a jury trial on whether you have a mental illness that subjects you to detainment and suspends a constitutional right. I think those
Mr. Allen was certainly detained, and he was detained upon a judicial finding that he had a mental illness. That's why he was arrested. So he was detained for 35 days without a jury trial, and nobody thought it was of any significance at all. How could that be?
I mean, I have to take another look at the case. I mean, my answer was that it wasn't raised, and if I recall correctly, that case was about a motion to vacate an order of commitment. So
wasn't that the one where the guardian had?
I think that might be the other one. I think that might be the Quesnel case.
Okay.
I might be mixing them up in my mind, but
because here a jury trial does have to commence by the 17th day, right? 3 plus 14.
The legislature has provided a probable cause determination, or you have to be brought before a court in 72 hours, and the state has to file a 14-day petition to commit you before the expiration of that 72 hours. That's what the statute
requires. And then if it goes beyond that, we're at 17 days, and then there's a jury trial, right?
Well, there's a jury trial right after the 14-day proceeding.
So that would be 17 days, right? 3 and 14 would be 17.
I'll trust Your Honor.
Sure.
On that.
And that would be, well, my point is that's half the time that Mr. Ellern was held without a jury trial. And nobody seemed to be bothered by it 70 years ago. All that much closer to statehood.
Well, I don't know if I have a good answer for Your Honor's concern.
That might be a good place to stop.
So I'd ask this court to recognize that the statutes are unconstitutional and to reverse SE's order of commitment.
Thank you. All right, next case, Koval versus Auburn.